This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're hitting the road. Our guide is writer and editor Robert Sullivan. He's driven across the USA more than 24 times, logging 90,000 miles. Sullivan's lived to tell the tale, and he tells it along with the story of one of his family's most recent road trips in his new book, Cross Country. Now, that's the title. Now, let me give you the title with its subtitle. Cross Country, 15 years and 90,000 miles on the roads and interstates of America with Lewis and Clark, a lot of bad motels, a moving van, Emily Post, Jack Kerouac, my wife, my mother-in-law, two kids, and enough coffee to kill an elephant. Listeners, I hope you'll join the conversation this afternoon with your travel stories and your questions for our guest, Robert Sullivan. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Robert Sullivan is the author now of five books, including the bestseller Rats. We talked with him about that book in April of 2004 here on the Afternoon Magazine, and you'll find that interview in the WILL archives at our website, WILL.UIUC.edu. Cross Country, 15 years and 90,000 miles on the roads and interstates of America with Lewis and Clark, a lot of bad motels, a moving van, Emily Post, Jack Kerouac, my wife, my mother-in-law, two kids, and enough coffee to kill an elephant is published by Bloomsbury. And the publication of this book coincides with two anniversaries, the return of Lewis and Clark 200 years ago in 1806, and the commencement of the interstate highway system 50 years ago in 1956. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Robert Sullivan, good to talk with you again.
Thank you for having me again.
My pleasure. Well, at the outset, one of the things you say is, in the roads of America is the history of America. Would you talk about that?
Well, I guess I kind of see the progression of roads across the country as being the same thing as the progression of the country across the continent. When you look at Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, sent off Lewis and Clark, he kind of sent them off to describe the country because in that kind of Enlightenment era thinking, to describe it was to kind of make it yours. And so Lewis and Clark were sent out to find that way across. But even more practically, or kind of closer to then home, Jefferson also set out to build the first national road, which was a big constitutional crisis. Could states come together and build a road, a national highway? But yeah, they got going on building this national road, which kind of went out of D.C. and went from the East Coast and through the Appalachians and the Cumberland Gap, and was headed towards St. Louis on the frontier at the time. But so you go from this sort of first one national road to a system of kind of private and national roads. And the U.S. highway system finally comes up in the early 1900s, in the 1920s and 30s. And then in the 40s and 50s, there more formalized U.S. highway system. And then finally, they kind of not throw that all out the window, but almost start again from scratch. And Eisenhower says, let's build an interstate highway system with which we finally seal the kind of deal that Jefferson started us up with, in which we spiderweb the entire continent that we described with these incredibly efficient, in some senses, superhighways. These sometimes up to 16 lane roadways that pretty much make it so that you can get anywhere from anywhere in the continental United States.
Yeah. What do you think of the modern, our contemporary interstate system?
Well, there's only an hour on the program, so I'd probably bore you all to death if I went on too much into it. But I guess I think that it's an amazing public works achievement that we built this 40 roughly 42,000-mile long thing. I mean, it's a like I say, it's kind of spider web of concrete, and you know, I can get across the country in one of my 20s. I could do it in 2 days, go from one coast to the other, or and that was even driving up into Canada and spending a little bit of rest time up in Canada for a while. But there's this other idea too that you can transport all these goods all around the country, and that's really the economic significance of the interstate system, is that billions of tons of goods are transported around our country from, you know, starting in 56 when the program was started. I mean, I guess the interstates aren't really laid down until the 70s, but, you know, from the 70s until now, it was this big economic boom and achievement. But that same sort of proximity of everywhere means that we've ended up with this thing that is maybe over-designed and overused. So when we're on a family cross-country trip, for instance, just my wife and I and two children, we'll be on the interstates, and again, these are sort of country crossing tools in a way, but we'll be on the interstates between, you know, say, Chicago and Madison and Wisconsin, and we'll be in traffic, in daily traffic. So we're using these cross-country tools to travel smaller and smaller distances, and as a result, the fact that more and more people use these roads, as a result, it takes longer and longer to travel more and more distances. And in a way, it's an over-engineered situation, and so you have this ability to go everywhere, and it ends up meaning that you sit in the car more and more. The average commuter, I think, travels something like 6,000 miles a year. That's a lot of miles. Not quite as much as Lewis and Clark, but it's close.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with you in Belgium, on line 4 in Belgium, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Where do I start? I started riding the highways back in the very, very, very early 50s, and I've been across the United States more times than I want to talk about. I would like to see how much sleep you got if you went from coast to coast in 2 hours. I've done
2 days.
Yeah, that's fast. but anyway, to get on to it, we used to travel the two-lane blacktops for years and years before there were interstates. And I've seen every kind of wreck that you can imagine. Car wrecks, truck wrecks, train wrecks, elephant wrecks, which was an interesting one as a child, let me tell you. See a dead elephant in the road makes you wonder. He hit his head on a bridge and was knocked off a truck, as best I can remember. But now, as I've gotten older, I took the interstates a lot, especially when I was a younger man, and thought they were the greatest thing in the world. And now, as I've gotten older, last year was the most recent time I've gone clear across the United States, and only partially did I get on the interstates, only when I had to get on them. And most of the times now, I've gone back to the two-lane roads because there's so much more to see and do and people to meet and just interesting things. I mean, you stop in at a roadside inn or a bunch of cabins that was built by the man who's the guy that's the host. You know, there's just innumerable places all across the United States. They're just far more interesting than the interstate that everybody seems to want to get on and run across. However, if I speak to friends and say, you know, it's great to go to San Francisco, but I like to drive, they just roll their eyes and say, how can you possibly do that? It's much better to fly. And I said, oh, you've missed so much of the United States by flying over to 30,000 feet. I was just wondering what your comments might be about that.
Well, it was more like 2 days, two and some days, when we drove across the country our kind of fastest.
Yeah.
And there was no sleep at all, such that I think I saw, if I recall correctly, I thought I was seeing cows in the Holland Tunnel in New York City, but that would be impossible, so But these are the kind of things you do when you're young, and if in my case you have a lot of hair at that point. No longer am I young, no longer do I have hair. But the safety crashes, of course, the interstate highway system, that's one of its great credits, is that it's reduced fatalities per capita significantly. And this is what we did. This is why we built the interstate highways the way we did. You know, you at first there were some big problems, but basically now, you know, you get onto a highway. If anybody will let you on, you speed up theoretically slowly, and you don't stop at a light the way you do still on the old, you know, on the old highways, like on old U.S. Route 40. If you went parallel to I-70 in the middle of Illinois, you know, you could see the old way, which is stopping at lights, and it was dangerous, and people got hurt, and apparently elephants as well. But then there's this other thing you mentioned about seeing America. Well, here's the deal. Everybody always says you can't see America on the interstates. If you want to see America, you have to get on the back roads and go find that place with the pie just baked, you know, on the counter. And I know a place in Osseo, Wisconsin, the North Canuck, where that pie is. And that's very true. On the back roads, you see America. And I was recently driving across South Dakota, an old U.S. highway, now state road, and it was so beautiful, and it was a two-lane blacktop highway, but that's that kind of, by saying that you see America that way, and you only see America that way, I have a little bit of a problem with that, you know, no offense, just the idea that that's ignoring the bulk of America, because unfortunately, whether we would all go on vacation to see it or not, whether we all want to see it or not, in lieu of spending more time in San Francisco. Unfortunately, the interstate highway America is America. It's a huge part of America. And if you want to see America, then you are faced with the fact that you have to go see or endure, in some people's cases, the roadside America that results, these exurbs, these cities that are sprung up around interstate exits that are, when you come and see them from afar, this bristle of first gas station signs and then Holiday Inn Express signs and then the giant Walmart and the vast parking lots surrounding the box stores. Those places that started out being just out by the interstate, big spaces where big companies could put in big things or relieve interstate travelers and feed them and house them for the evening, those places have become places. And more of those places are popping up than the places where they're going to serve the steaming pie on the counter, unfortunately. And for me, that's another reason to see this, to see what America is also. And so when you see the kind of the America that I too enjoy visiting, the pie on the counter America, that's I also call that the presidential candidate America. That's the America that presidential candidates show up to be photographed in, and that's great. And I've on our trip this summer, you know, in Dayton, Ohio, at the Pine Club, an old restaurant. Man, that was Dayton, Ohio. That was it. We were there, but. On the other hand, there's this other America that people pretend isn't there, and I'm not saying you pretend it isn't there, but that we have to kind of face, and the interstates have given us this ability to not ever walk, and nobody walks anymore. And it used to be in the 50s that the number of trips within a mile of your home, something like 20% of them were taken by car, done by car. But now these days, it's getting up to 80 and 90% of the trips within a mile of your home are done by car.
The point I'd like to make, though, also from what you're saying, I see Walmart and Ramada and whoever else it may be strung along in these little pearls along the interstate every day. But it's not every day I get to drive on U.S. 50 from Carson City, Nevada to Ely, Nevada, and never see another car. And we're talking a distance of 200-300 miles.
Sure, but then you get into the problem where those areas are depopulating, and people are moving out of those areas because there aren't any jobs there. And then it'll be great to drive through, but that America will be forced to move to where there are those jobs that that are coming up, which are the jobs back at the places along the interstates. I'm not saying it's not great to drive that road. That's a great road. It's a great drive. But, you know, what is it that you're seeing? What's in the landscape that you're seeing? What does it mean that you don't see anybody along that road? And that what does it mean that the drive across Montana on the interstate, or even on Route 12, I believe it is, but mm-hmm. but the drive across Montana, say, on the interstate, used to be kind of like the drive you just described along U.S. 50. But now it's full of houses. It's full of suburbs that are around no city. They call it a ruburb, a rural suburb, has popped up in the middle of the Yellowstone, you know, River Valley. It kind of in, and I know this isn't the case because it's definitely somewhere. Whenever you're in Montana, it's so somewhere. But in another sense, it's in the middle of nowhere, and there's this drain on the watershed, and what is that? And that's a result of our ability and our wish to cross the country more effectively, more efficiently, and faster. I'm with you, though. I love driving across. However, I could have stood to stay, spend a few more days in San Francisco this time because San Francisco was so beautiful.
Isn't it, though? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And it's a great walking city.
Oh, my God.
<Isn't>
I think the number one walking city said Walking Magazine, was it? I don't know what,
yeah.
But I was also in Portland, Oregon, which is another great walking city.
Yeah, Chicago's pretty good too.
Chicago's really great, and Indianapolis, as you may know, is building an in-city walking/hiking trail. It's kind of an amazing thing. It's a really kind of radical notion.
Writer, editor, and traveler Robert Sullivan is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Cross Country. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, your road stories, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. 90,000 miles.
I think it's closer to 100,000 now.
Is it now?
We did
okay.
8,000 or 9,000 this summer.
Where did you go this summer?
This summer we accidentally circumnavigated the United States of America. We didn't mean to, but we went down through D.C. and Texas and then through Phoenix, where I guess, you know, road rage seems really bad. And it just seems like almost, you see so much interstate-style development around Phoenix. But anyway, then up into L.A., and I think it was 100, and it was very hot. And then up into L.A. and up into San Francisco, and then Portland, Oregon, Seattle, and then back through the north, through Montana and Minnesota and Milwaukee, and then down to Chicago, and then down through Dayton, and then back kind of through the Cumberland back, kind of sort of through the Cumberland Gap back, kind of through, actually in Wheeling, West Virginia, I noticed there's a Lebanese community. I was very excited to see they were having a fair that day. And then back through the Delaware Water Gap into the Hudson River watershed.
Mm-hmm. When did you start and when did you get home?
Gosh, I guess we started at the end of June, because I remember my son and I ran in a race, a running race in Oxford, Mississippi on the 4th of July, and we got back in the very first week of August. And I have to say, even though I do enjoy driving across the country, I think I might have had it. I think this might be it.
Wow.
I think I might not be able to drive anymore.
Has that been something, though, that you've said to yourself before at the end of a long trip?
Actually, I've said it every single time. But this time, it has to be true because, I mean, the price of gas, just while we've been talking, it's gone up $20-$25 a gallon. So I'm sure. There's no way I'm going to be able to afford it next year. Up until this year, it's always been more economical to drive than it is to buy four tickets for a family at kind of at the last minute because we never know when we can leave. And we're just trying to, you know, go from one kind of grandmother's house to the other grandmother's house from the East Coast to the West Coast.
Yeah.
But It can't be. I'm thinking it won't be economical ever again, more economical. So.
Yeah. How old are your children now?
My son is 15 and my daughter is 10.
And what do they think of these family cross-country events?
It's a long drive for them, too. But, you know, they're kind of pluses and minuses. The minuses are, in this case, 8,000 miles. That's a minus. But a plus might be, I know my daughter loves Santa Fe, for instance, and Taos, and she might never have loved it. And she loves Austin, Texas so much. She likes to go to the vintage stores there. And I know also that a plus for my son was when he was looking around for mandolin, we went to all these stores around the country and looked at old mandolins and finally found one in I guess it was St. Paul, Minnesota.
Yeah. Isn't that one of the ways that your son signaled to you that, you know, the question being, are we there yet? You know, he'd say, do you think there'll be musical instruments this exit,
yep.
Dad?
Believe it or not, they might have the same genetic flaws that I do. Hopefully not as many of them. But they were even revved up for the Chicago architecture tour that you take on the boat.
Oh, that's great.
And it even paid off. It was as good as we all hoped it would be. And we went to Frank Lloyd Wright's house in Oak Park, but we'd also seen Frank Lloyd Wright's only skyscraper in, I think it's Bartlesville, Oklahoma. I mean, and I mean this in the most positive sense, of course, when I'm referring to the young people in our party, but I suppose we're kind of boring, but we were easily excited by such things. But yeah, it's a really hard trip. I mean, it's really hard, but my son is very up to date now on every cool music magazine, he would take apart huge sections of the paper every day. My daughter read about 5 books. I think people are more astounded that we drove across the country without DVD players than at any other aspect of the trip.
Hmm. Let's talk with some more listeners next. We're going to go to a listener in Savoy on line 1. Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon. I don't know if you addressed it or not, but I wanted to ask you about Amtrak services in the United States and mention my son and I were able this summer to take the train from Chicago to Glacier National Park.
Oh, did you love it?
Yeah, it was very nice. The park was very good, and I'd love to put a plug in for that because it's a great place to visit. I recommend everybody do that if they can. The train service looks like it's very slow in upgrading, and some of the Amtrak employees were saying that at the federal level, Amtrak's really losing support and so forth. And I don't know if you have done much looking into that sort of thing.
Well, I love taking the train across country too, and we've done that a bunch, and we've done it over the years, and Glacier National Park is a great stop, and it's significant in the kind of pitching of America to Americans, because a lot of the first long distance travels that Americans did were to go to places that the railroads promoted, and Glacier National Park is an instance of the railroad company building a lodge and promoting in Chicago and in the Twin Cities where James J. Hill, the Hill family, was from, the Hill family owning the railroad, promoting, you know, Glacier National Park, come to this place, this beautiful natural spot, and revive yourself from your urban grind. This was this idea that then was translated to early car driving, and people would say, you know, go be Thoreau on 29 cents a gallon by driving your car out to these great places. And that ended up being problematic because people just drove their cars anywhere and camped anywhere, much to farmers' chagrin. But the train across the country is amazing, and it's beautiful. And, you know, I took the train, actually. I was so tired of driving. By the time I got to Portland, I took the train from Portland to Seattle, and it was great. And on the way back, we got stuck because there was all this freight train traffic, because freight traffic is way up because it's economical, and train still makes sense. But people on the Amtrak train, the people were saying, oh, my God, this is horrible. Amtrak service is so bad. But meanwhile, Amtrak doesn't own the tracks. The freight lines own the tracks. Well, I'm not doing a good job of getting to my point, but here's my point about rail service. People are constantly complaining about how Amtrak's not that good, you know, doesn't really go anywhere, and it just keeps getting worse and worse. And every year, the government cuts out funding for Amtrak. Mm-hmm. The Bush administration has all but set people in to take it apart. And yet people, especially in the Northwest and in the West, still rely on it and use it. I mean, I took the train from Chicago to Milwaukee. It was great. Towns all across the country, cities are trying to link themselves to their airports with new train lines. And here's our national train service, and all we do is cut from it. I'm sorry I'm getting upset.
No.
And then after we cut from it, we say, oh, my God, can you believe how bad this is? Well, it's crazy. And now here we are in the 25th year of the interstate highway system. And the highway system itself, and I'm sure everybody's turning off the radio and hanging up phones because nobody wants to hear me on this, but I have this idea of this of re-engineering, in a sense, the interstate highway systems. We have this amazing system, this great system that reaches all these places, but we can't afford to keep it going because the gas tax is how we fund repair. The roads are falling apart. In Indiana, they've sold the toll roads to a company to run the toll roads. So now we have a public road being run by, as it happens, out-of-country company. So we have to face these questions. Well, why do we have to just fix up the interstates for cars? Why can't we add what they have in Bogota, Colombia, which are these kind of high speed, almost train-like buses with stations along the interstates, for instance, rather than just, you know, bus stops in towns. Why can't we add rail along or alongside the interstates to augment rather than cut back on the Amtrak system? Because people are really tired of spending their entire life in the car, and we somehow, as a government, we, and I'm not saying it's the government is them and not me, because I'm the government as a voting citizen, but somehow we have not figured out how to make our government look to the future when there's going to be a lot of broken up roads and nobody will be able to afford to buy the gas to fix them up. So Amtrak is such a disappointment, not because of Amtrak. Amtrak, I mean, riding a train, it's not just a romantic, I love romantic train rides, but it's just a practical solution to the problems we have. But we have this idea, I think, in America especially, but all over the world, but especially in America, if it's not new, it's not good. It's hard for us to think of old technology as being technology. We think it has to be really shiny and have come out in the last 6 months to be technology. But the idea of the railroad is still a very practical, successful, technologically advanced idea. We don't have to just drive to get somewhere.
I see. One of the arguments that people were making was that federal dollars shouldn't be going to support vacationing.
Well, it's kind of funny because you could say that federal dollars with the interstates, it sounds like, you know, they're paying for us to commute and things like that. But really, the interstate, the bulk of what they do is, I mean, a huge part of what they do is truck traffic. So, vacationing, it sounds like the roads are for vacationing, but they're not. Well, you know, I think that I have this idea that here's an ideal situation, it's not going to happen probably, but I wish it would. If we only drove for vacation. In other words, if we commuted by train or even carpool every day to work, then that would be a huge difference in how we use fuel. I know that each item of food on your plate travels an average of 1,300 miles to get there. It comes from several countries on average. That's all coming from the roads. I mean, it won't just be vacation. It may start out vacation, and the other thing is, what's so bad about that? If federal dollars for vacation. Is that bad?
That's a good question. I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got another.
I'm sorry, I'm talking too much. Sorry, listener.
Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hi. We regularly travel from Illinois to north central Ohio, and in the summertime when there's more light, we take a combination of small amount of interstate and back roads. And we've used, there's a new set of, well, not all that new. There's a company called the DeLorme Map Company.
Okay, yes, DeLorme, yes, yes.
It makes state atlases. And a lot of people haven't discovered these, but they really are nice for having, for improvising and or
yes.
setting up a route to get somewhere other than by, to get alternate routes.
Yes, they come out, I think they're made in Maine, right?
Right.
And they're made, they have a great giant sort of globe in their building along the highway in Maine, actually, I've seen it.
Well, the other thing is that they, because they are, it's like a Rand McNally Road Atlas, but there's one for each state.
Yes.
And so there's a lot of detail. So we got one for Kansas because we were driving to see a son in Denver, and it's a long way to drive.
Yep.
And we wanted to take some breaks. And I was intrigued because they had a lot of little places to see, off, not very far off the interstate.
No, I know. Little state parks, for instance, right? Little state parks are great for those maps.
Oh, no. There was a place called the Garden of Eden, for instance. And a friend told me about this. There was an eccentric sort of guy around the turn of the century. He'd been in the Civil War, and he built in his little backyard. It's a town like any of the small towns around Champaign-Urbana. In his backyard, he began to build these concrete sculptures.
Huh.
And he had a very political bent. And it's really cool stopping and
yeah.
seeing his backyard with these really offbeat sculptures. That was just one thing. So it took us maybe an hour and a half to do this, and saw some scenery on the way. So it was a combination of interstate and back roads. And if you have some decent maps, then you can cobble together something that works for you. So I just wanted to suggest that. Thanks.
That's a great suggestion.
Oh, no, I love the DeLorme maps, and I have this bad habit of just sitting around reading maps just for fun. And well, I think the combination of interstate and you know, off interstate is great. I mean, you know, again, we have this kind of accidental specialty where, you know, we're very practiced at driving cross country, but it's practical. I mean, we have to get there, and we can't stay in the car for too long, otherwise there might be a mutiny or one of us will lose it. And so that's always what we try to do. And those kinds of places, that kind of folk art stuff, for lack of a better word, they're rock gardens, for instance, in the Northwest and in the Southwest. People would build cairns and beautiful cities of rock. And, you know, there's an artist named Finster in the South. You can see his paintings and his... that he painted all around his house and stuff. No, that's the best. And DeLorme makes the really great maps, great maps.
And how do you spell that company?
I think it's DeLorme.
DeLorme, okay.
Yeah, but they're in Maine. And they're at a lot of good camping stores now. And they've sort of been going a couple atlases at a time. Used to just be able to get a few states,
mm-hmm.
and now you can get a bunch.
Yeah. Well, for the trip that you write about in cross country directly, you used AAA's Triptych.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, Triptych by AAA, I'm sure some people know, they're little rectangular maps, and you hold them, and they're bound on the top, a spiral bound, and you flip them over, long side over the top, so that you see just where you're traveling in that day or in that hour. They seem to me to be direct descendants of the kind of river maps that Clark drew on the Lewis and Clark journey, where he would just draw where he was on the river and say, and coming up here to the right, there's a shoot-off, and that's the Clark Fork, and there's the Lewis Fork, and there's the North Clark Fork and the North Lewis Fork. Because I guess they would run out of names. But the triptych is kind of the modern version of that, and it shows your interstate, and it shows where there's gas at each exit, or food, or lodging, or AAA-approved lodging, and it lines up with a book that you have, a tra- travel guide. But I have to say, I stopped using the triptychs last year, and my wife actually cut up old maps and made triptychs for us this time, kind of like the way she makes a quilt every year while we drive.
It's very interesting, you know, reading your book, I learned that the core of discovery expedition of Lewis and Clark was almost forgotten. It sort of was in a drawer, so to speak. And that leads me to want to ask you now about how you and your family have recorded your trips.
Well, everybody's kept journals, sometimes extensive journals, sometimes not that extensive. But when I sat down to write this book, I realized that I had, you know, I had this 15 or more years of just notes that I'd taken from little notebooks that I'd had over the years. Because I remember wanting so badly to write, to record my first trip across with my wife, who I was then dating, and I just thought it was just phenomenal. Maybe that's just coming from the East. I don't know. I know lots of people have journals and record their trips, but I felt really, I guess that's the one and probably only advantage of being from the East, was that I got to consider more of the country to be the West. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, I used to joke that being from New York City and growing up in Queens and New Jersey, I always thought that the West was Eastern Pennsylvania. So that's my one advantage, being born on the island of Manhattan.
Yeah. Robert Sullivan is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, Cross Country. Let's talk with another listener. A listener in Indiana on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I'm sorry I didn't get on early. I've been listening to it, and it was coming up, but I didn't make it. But I just wanted to throw this one in. Perhaps he's already done it or a part of it. When I was a youngster and got my bicycle, and I started riding out in the county roads over here in Indiana, I decided that one day I was going to start in this small town and go all the way to the west by county roads. And I got a plethora of maps all the way across the country from the different state transportation agencies and stuff. I had all these things planned out. Of course, I never made it. I got fairly good distance into Illinois before the engine decided that we're not going anywhere else. And I, of course, was a student. I didn't have the money to continue. But I just wondered if anybody's actually done that, or a good part of it, or something like that, because that really appeals to me for some reason, that's for sure. Thanks a lot.
I think that's really, first of all, I love the idea that different ways of traveling across the country appeal to different people. I love that there are so many different ways you can think of to go across the country. I did read recently about somebody who visited every state capital, but it was more than that, I think. Tried to go to every county seat in his state, something like that. But there are these epic quests, these self-made epic quests all out there, all around there. We were trying to get from, I guess we were in Montana, and we were trying to get over to Minnesota. On this last tour, we were stopping at bookstores to read, to do readings and get people to sing a couple road songs maybe at these bookstores. And we had to get from, I guess we were in Missoula, and we were trying to find a shortcut along through North Dakota. So my wife had the idea, I think it was North Dakota. My wife had the idea that we would cut through, take a state road, and it was kind of, well, you know, you're taking a chance, but it ended up being faster. But it was the only time on this cross-country trip that we couldn't get a hotel at night, and it was because there were a lot of firefighters in the hotel fighting fires. There were fires all over the country this summer, and I guess still are. But the other thing that's significant about that to me is, I think it says something about traveling and gas prices. There were no vacancy signs when we crossed this time. We didn't have any problem finding a motel, you know, a cheap motel late at night. And that's the first time ever that that's happened. We have had times where we've broken down, and that's been difficult, but in the end kind of fun. And I also end up locking the keys in the car on every trip, as I did on this most most recent trip in Jackson, Mississippi, where I got to meet a very nice, you know, locksmith.
Wow. I guess that's what you have to do when you're traveling, especially if it's something that you're doing at your, well, I guess we don't really think of leisure anymore, do we?
No, we don't. That's kind of the problem with the roads, right? That's another thing that the roads do to us. There is that opportunity for leisure. The idea of traveling county roads is the opposite of what we're supposed to think of when we think of roads. Even when going on vacation, we're supposed to take the fastest road possible. We've got to get up there at 6.
Yeah.
We've got to do that. So that's the thing. We're all about efficiency and streamlining and it makes me want to say, as I've already said, I'm never going to do it again. I'm never going to cross the country again. I'm just going to stay where I am. I'm just going to go a short distance and try to enjoy where I am. Is, where it was, is, am.
There's probably great pie just around the corner.
I know there is. Well, actually, we have great pie at our house.
Yeah, yeah. We're running down on time, unfortunately. We could talk a lot longer. Wish we could all get together in the car and have a nice long trip.
You would probably collapse from boredom with me the first hour and a half.
I don't know.
15 minutes.
I don't know.
10 minutes.
I don't know. One of the things that you say early, really early in the book, and we've been kind of talking around this here through the interview, is all of America's glory can be divided into two categories, the obvious and the less obvious. Talk with us about the less obvious. Give us an example or two.
Well, you know, I sort of have that problem that I can't figure out how to divide it when I just think about the interstate itself, the interstate system itself, because it's glorious in its reach and its achievement as an engineering project, but it's also, you know, banal, and it's just so there's this other aspect of it. But I think when we did this last trip, we drove across, as I said, we came through the Delaware Water Gap. Across the Delaware River, a la George Washington, except it wasn't cold, and we came into New Jersey, and we had to cross under. We went through a tunnel, the Hudson River, to get into New York and then Brooklyn, where we live. And we went through the Meadowlands in New Jersey, which is known as the place where Jimmy Hoffa might have been buried, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I know everybody has their local kind of favorite idea where he's buried, but a famous place. It's the sports stadium there. But it's also kind of what's considered to be an industrial wasteland. You know, there's all these ruined factories or even chemical factories and things that are still going, but it's very industrial. And people say, oh, this is industrial. How could this be beautiful? How could this be pretty? But there's some kind of elegance to it. And it's a landscape that's actually really, really beautiful, and I'd forgotten how beautiful it was. And on this trip, I also saw, I mean, in this past year of traveling, I also saw another place that reminded me of it. I drove from Chicago to Detroit, and I drove kind of near Gary. And between Gary, Indiana, and Chicago, there was another similar place full of factories and swamps, places that people traditionally have never cared about. People don't like swamps. They say we got to fill it in with garbage dumps. And that there are places like those industrial wastelands all around the country. But when I got back to my kind of home industrial wasteland, I was just really struck by how beautiful it was, especially since people often talk about it as being so ugly. It's just glorious in its kind of ruined smokestack way, and I guess I was overexcited in trying to describe it to the kids as we crossed through it. But I took all these, you know, we were so dying to get home, and I was so intent on it was bumper to bumper traffic on the interstate getting into the Holland Tunnel, getting into New York City, and I knew this area because I had actually even written a book about this area, the Meadowlands, and I knew that I could take the old colonial roads to beat traffic into the tunnel, to beat the toll, to pull in on the last local road before the toll. And usually that's a recipe for disaster when I'm driving. But it worked this time. And it was good to come home through this ugly seeming to many people, but to me, really beautiful spot, this wasteland.
Mm. Well, Robert Sullivan, happy trails.
Thank you very much. And a great Woody Guthrie song at the beginning.
Yeah, car song. Good to talk with you.
Likewise.
Take care.
Thank you.
Robert Sullivan's latest book is Cross Country, 15 Years and 90,000 Miles on the Roads and Interstates of America with Lewis and Clark, A Lot of Bad Motels, A Moving Van, Emily Post, Jack Kerouac, My Wife, My Mother-in-Law, Two Kids, and Enough Coffee to Kill an Elephant. The publisher is Bloomsbury.